We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages and hear our speaker tonight. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, we're 1 week late having David. I agreed to put David on the microphone for his 14th birthday. And that would have been last Monday night in my scheduling here. As I can see with the crowd that's here tonight, everything worked out perfect. So David is a past president of NABA Club. He's very active in service, secretary of the newcomers group on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock. And I heard a portion of his story not too long ago in the Thursday night men's group, and I was intrigued, and I certainly wanted to hear more. So please come up and share your story, David.
Everybody that read, and Ed and Ray, and let's see who else read. Tom, I hadn't seen Tom in many, many years. I talked to Tom the other day on the phone a couple, two, 3 weeks ago, I guess it was, and Tom told me he was in Al-Anon now, and I don't know how you managed to sneak into AA that way, but you'll be here sooner or later. At least from what I remember. But anyway, it's good to see you. You lived through a good part of it. And but anyway, I want to thank everybody. Thank you all for coming. I did get sober in 1995, August the 3rd. It's the last drink of liquor I had. My drug of choice was Canadian Mist Crown Royal when I can afford it. And we'll just leave it at that. I know it's sinless purpose, but there's some other things involved. I might mention somewhere along the way, I guarantee if I do, that I drug very alcoholically, and I'll try to make that clear. And I'd also like to thank all of my, since I've been here, I guess I've had 5 sponsors. And first I had Billy B. from Biscayne Room, and Billy was tragically killed, not immediately, but he was in a wheelchair for a long time after an automobile wreck he had. I was living in one of Harry's houses, and Harry, thank you for coming. And the day that I got the news from Billy, I didn't know what to do. His roommate Bill called me and told me about the accident, and he said he needed to get a temporary sponsor, and I didn't know what to do. And I looked out, and Harry was out there cutting the grass, and I said, there goes one. And so I went out and asked Harry to come be, if he'd be my sponsor. And Harry was my sponsor until, I guess, about 5 or 6 years ago. And Harry's still my sponsor today. As a matter of fact, I hadn't had anybody fire me. I hadn't fired anybody from being my sponsor. But Harry works with a lot of newcomers and stays right in the thick of the program. And I found out, I guess, something like 6 years ago that I had hepatitis C, and I became a very needy person. I got real sick and was sick for a couple of years on this interferon they put you on. It makes you real sick. And I started going to meetings every day at the 8 o'clock over Clarkson, and there was a guy over there named Richard Campbell that was there every day, and I explained the situation to him, and I told him I had a sponsor, but I needed some. I told him he could see how needy I was. Anybody could. Ray Charles could see that. And so I started calling him every day, and he put up with me for a couple of years, and then I told Harry what I was doing. I told him that I had a sponsor and so forth, but that he was busy working with newcomers and houses and everything. I need somebody I can bug every day for a long time. And so anyway, then he moved to Elizabethton, Tennessee, and he lived up there for, I guess, a year and a half before I really started talking to Ray about being my sponsor. And then when I called and told him that, he said, well, I've only been gone a year and a half. You probably should have done that in 90 days, so that's about right. And so anyway, so that's sort of my story. I've always had a sponsor, except I guess for about a year that Richard was in Tennessee, and I was sort of winging it by myself. But anyway, I was born here in Atlanta in 1957, July 7th, and so I've never lived more than, I guess, 15, 20 miles miles from here, and I was born to my dad, nice dad for coming, my wife Mary, dad and mom lived over in DeKalb County, and they went to Decatur Presbyterian Church. Dad did. They moved out south to DeKalb County. They started a church out there with six or seven other couples, and so that's where we lived until I guess I was about, old enough to throw out. I was about 18, something like that. And so we lived over a long way for a good many years, and then I went to Columbia High School, and I can just remember that the whole time when I was growing up, I never did exactly feel just right. I never didn't know why. I just thought everybody felt like that. But anyway, I always everything. I was like a square peg in a round hole, and I didn't know exactly why I felt so uncomfortable. But I know that I did. And we had a good growing up life. We went to the lake during the summer. My uncle had a place up at Lake Allatoona. We went up there and spent a lot of time. And Dad traveled for 35 years. We spent time on the road with him during the summer. We'd take turns. My brother, I have one brother, and he'd go out of town with Dad 1 week, and I'd go out of town the next week, and Dad would be out working. We'd stay at the rim and swim and whatever, and have a pretty good life. Mom was a school teacher. So I can't really see where I went off the track, let's say, but at least at that time I thought I had. Now I don't think so, but it just looked to me like, I remember the first time I ever, well, I can remember, let me back up, I can remember when my uncle David used to talk to us up at the lake, and this was around the time of the beginning of the Vietnam War, and marijuana was beginning to be, you heard all about it all the time, and so forth, and he would say, he would preach to us, to me and my brother and all the other little cousins, you should never drink and all that, be drunk, you know, you shouldn't drink, and you should definitely don't smoke marijuana. We don't know, you know, and so I grew up with that, you know, knowing that we didn't want to drink or smoke marijuana. We were preached to about that, and I had to have good, clear knowledge of what not to do there. So anyway, I made it till I guess about 14 years old. A lot of the kids were in my grade were beginning to camp out and drink. I remember this old Hopping Gator beer they used to buy. They put it in the creek with a string and then pull it out and drink it cold and so forth. And they done. And I would think, well, we're not supposed to do that. We're not supposed to do that. You know? And then one time I was working in the service station. And I wanted to buy the car that I had my eye on was a Chevelle SS396, and my parents didn't want me to have it. But they wanted me to have a car, but they didn't want me to have that car. So I manipulated my way into getting it. And the way I did that was I got a job at the service station, and they had X number of dollars that they were willing to spend on an automobile, and I was going to add to that with this money that I saved working this gas station and get the car I wanted. So anyway, while I was working this gas station, this guy that worked part-time during the week when I did came up to me one time. This guy had his pickup truck backed into one of the bays. It was around Christmas time, and this was back in the days before credit cards and cell phones and all that, and so people would come by and pay their bill at the end of the month, and so this guy had been down to the liquor store and gotten all different kinds of liquors and wines and beers and all that, and had on back of his truck, and he backed it in the bay of the service station. When all the guys come by to pay their bill for the month, they'd have a drink. So this guy asked me, he said, "Dave, do you want a drink?" I said, "Sure." You know, and I never had one. He said, "How about a Tom Collins?" I said, "Oh, yeah, that's great." So, you know, he fixed it, and I drank it, and hell, I drank it down like Kool-Aid, and it tasted good. And by the time I finished half of that, all of that stuff that I've been carrying around with me all my life, that uncomfortable feeling was gone. And I didn't know that I didn't know about the timing of, you know, having a half one now and now when to have the other half one. What I thought was I was supposed to have all the Kool-Aid I could drink, you know. And so what I did was I drank, I don't know how many of them, but I know Dave came by about an hour or so later and pulled his car in. And I remember my Uncle George used to always call him Jack Boy up the lake when they were drinking. And he when he used to be drunk, you know, we get up there and, hey, Jack Boy, and all this. So I saw Dad pull in. I said, hey, Jack Boy. And Dad said, get in the damn car. First thing he said. And so, it didn't work for me. So I got in the car and he took me home. And by the time we got halfway home, he had pulled the car over. I was throwing up sick. And we got the car home and I was sick several times before we ever got home. I was real sick when we got home. And of course, my mother didn't know why. And she put me to bed and brought me chicken noodle soup and crackers and all this crap. And Dad didn't want me to tell her why I was sick. So, you know, I was sitting up there in the bed with the hangover and for the first time. But all I could think about, and I was sick for several days. I mean, I was really, really sick from that. But all I could ever think about the whole time was how long it was going to be how I was going to get some more of that. Because in the very beginning, before I got so sick, it was such a relief to have all that pressure that built up inside of me for 15 years or whatever it was, which is gone. I mean, it's just, I felt like a normal person. So, that was the very beginning of my drinking career, I guess you'd call it. And so that was about 15, and I drank, and I began to drink then, and I got in trouble, and I drank all the time, and I was an instant alcoholic. I drank, I don't even remember how I get it, but I used to get, but Dad had gin at the house, and I used to drink as much of that as I thought I could get by with drinking. And there wasn't a lot of booze around the house, but I was good at getting booze and other things and keeping it where I could get to it before I go to school. I never did make very good grades in school. And I can remember summer school. I can remember many days of summer school drinking before I'd go to school. And so, anyway, I was an alcoholic then, and I continued on and just kept right on drinking and kept right on drinking. I didn't know any other way. And I can remember when the other things in my life could never. I always get sick, and I always get so drunk, and I get in fights, and I remember when I started these other things. The reason I started taking other things besides booze, and I won't go into that extensively, but I do remember that there was one particular thing that I remember that if I took, that would keep me from getting drunk, I could drink like a gentleman. And I always wanted to drink like a gentleman because we used to go to this place called the Commodity Exchange over at North Lake, and at one time you could buy, they went up for a quarter of beer, one time you could buy them for a penny of beer, and we'd go in there and we'd buy 100, you know, with a dollar. And they'd put them on the table, and we'd sit there and we'd drink, and everybody'd drink, and they'd order food and everything. We'd go to the Mad Hatter in Underground Atlanta, and I'd always get real drunk, and I'd always wind up sick. But I knew when I took this drug that I took, which was speed, and I always, when I snorted something, I could drink like a gentleman. So I, like Bill Wilson, tried other types of things to go along with it, and it worked for me for a long time. So anyway, I continued on, and I got in trouble. I wound up getting in all kinds of trouble with, I think the first DUI I got, I don't even think I made it until I was 18 years old. I think I was 17, and I continued to get, I think I got 8 of them before I was through getting DUIs. And I always had trouble keeping a driver's license. I was always in trouble with the law for that. Getting pulled over with different types of things, an automobile I wasn't supposed to have, and wasn't always just booze, but I always had plenty of whatever it was. And back in those days, it wasn't nearly as bad as it is now. From what I understand now, they're a little more strict. And I probably would have had a lot more than 8 DUIs, because I don't know how many times I was taken home with for driving drunk. And one time I ran my car off the road and fell asleep at the wheel out on 285, and they called Mom and Dad, and they came and got me. So it was always some kind of trouble connected with it. And as many times as I tried to quit, I could never quit. And I knew a long time before I quit that it was a problem. And I knew I had a problem. By the time I was 18 years old, it was clear. me that I needed to quit drinking. And that's one of the things about AA is that, you know, AA is for people who want it, not for people who need it. If AA was for people who need it, then I'm sure that my parents or anybody in my family that loved me, that cared anything about me, that could have picked my bottle for me, would have picked it when I was about 18. But yet, I drank until I was 37. So it took me 19 more years of trying to figure out how I was going to end this long run of bad luck I was on and turn it around, because that's what I thought I was on. I really didn't realize. I wouldn't swallow the fact that that my life was unmanageable. And so I think that I probably worked the first step way before I ever got to AA, the first step. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol long before I ever got to AA. And people used to make jokes about me being an alcoholic, and I knew I was an alcoholic, but I knew I wasn't going to quit drinking. And so I knew way back, and I don't know when, but somewhere around 20 years old, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. But I didn't admit until 1995 that my life was unmanageable. And that was when when you get as many DUIs as I had, the judge will tell you that you have to go to a certain number of AA meetings and get your sheet signed and all that. And I did that. So I'd been to enough AA meetings to know I knew a lot of folks. I knew a lot of guys that had been here then for 10 or 15 years would see me come in and out. Every time you get a DUI, you're back in, you know, and the same guys would be there. Some of them, a lot of them, you know. And sometimes I'd go to different places, but hell, you know, there's only so many places in Atlanta before we know you get all these DUIs. So I had heard enough people say that if you ever got on your knees and asked God to remove the obsession, that God would do that. And I always thought to myself, well, that boy, that guy must be a real bad alcoholic, you know. It wasn't until 1995 that I realized that I was one of those alcoholics that needed to either die or keep on drinking until I died, or either I was going to have to do something. I tried everything else, and so what I did was I got a DUI, my eighth DUI. They sent me to a boot camp down in South Georgia, and this wasn't my first trip down there. I've been down there before to a different one, but it's not my first trip to boot camp. And so they sent me down there to this was Hancock County, I think it was, and I went through the DeKalb County Jail, and this was when O.J. Simpson was on trial for all the trouble he got in. And so I'll never forget, that's just how I can remember when that was I remember I was in the DeKalb County Jail the day he went to court, and about 3 days later they sent me to Jackson, and I was in Jackson, and they processed my paperwork or whatever, and did the tests on me and so forth, and sent me to Hancock County, and they have a boot camp down there, and they sent me there. So when I was there, this was also during the year when the Olympics were coming to Atlanta, and since I had a lot of construction experience, they put me on this detail of building up rest areas at this Alexander Stevens State Park down in Hancock County. And I started thinking about, you know, I was thinking about my whole life. You know, I wasn't drinking, so I had a lot of time to think clearly. And I've had an awful lot of DUIs. I've tried an awful lot of different things to quit drinking. And my life had just been one thing after another one. And I was just about sick of it. And I'd had some brushes with death due to alcohol and so forth. I was just sick of it. I just didn't say I'd keep on any longer. I just had enough. And so I started, one time I went to church, and there was this guy on the bunk next to mine named Truman, like the old president we had. And his name was Harry Truman. And he was a writer. He'd written several books, several children's books, and he was, and I'd look at him and read them and everything. And he'd gotten a DUI, and he was from Macon, Georgia, and he'd gotten a DUI and gotten this boot camp too. So he was dead sold that there was no God. You couldn't tell Truman there was any such thing as God, and he could flat tell you why. And he knew all about the evolution, the Big Bang, and if you listen to him long enough, he could tell you about it. And he, and I listened to him one night after church, this Sunday night after church, and he went all through the deal and everything. And so when he finished, he told me how it all happened and everything. And I remember thinking towards the end of his little deal that everything he said could be true. I mean, I'm not really a professor, and I'm not that religious a person, although I was raised going to church and know a good bit about how the Presbyterian Church came to be and so forth. And I've done a little bit, you have to know a little bit about theology to be in the Presbyterian Church, go through community class and all that. But still, that I'm not an easy person to sell. And I listened to everything I was willing to listen to. And so I wasn't real satisfied with any of that, no more than I was with what Truman had to say. But anyway, when he went through his whole story, I thought, well, he could be right about everything he said. And still, it had to start somewhere. So I think wherever all this started is what I'm going to choose to call my higher power. And I started thinking about that, and I thought, this world couldn't have just come from nothing. And I'm not sure that I'll ever know exactly how it all came, if I live to be 1,000 years old, but I do know that we just didn't appear here by mistake. And there is some higher power, and the way I had that proven to me was I got on my knees that night, and I asked God to relieve the obsession for me to drink. And I had been thinking about drinking every day. Although I was in a boot camp, before the boot camp I was in Jackson, before that I was in jail, all I could think about was when I get out of here I'm going to do this, when I get out I'm going to do that. And then they put me on this detail going out and working in this rest area, and a lot of the guys would, first thing we'd do when we get out there that day, they'd go to the trash can, around the trash can, and they'd see where the guys that had dates that Saturday night before had left their half a six pack of Michelob or Budweiser or whatever, and they'd find it, and of course it was hot. But if you hadn't had anything to drink in 4 months and you're an alcoholic, you don't care. And I was always thinking, man, why can't I be one of those lucky guys that finds a half a six pack somewhere? Damn. And then I would think, now how do they get the gonads to drink that? And all these things run through my mind all the time. The obsession was there. And I didn't realize for 3 days that I hadn't even thought about it. The obsession was gone. And instead of course, this was the day that I asked God to remove that obsession was when it occurred. I didn't realize for a couple of days. I started thanking God for removing that obsession. And I have not had an obsession to drink a drink, thank God, with all the other crap that I've brought on myself in my life. And since 1995, I hadn't had a drink. And that's a pretty powerful statement for somebody that's been trying to learn how to drink for all those years, and then all of a sudden asked God to relieve the obsession, and God did that. So I had no, that was when I started, recognizing that my life was unmanageable. I knew I was powerless over alcohol all that time, and I started really seeing how unmanageable my life was when I was sitting in a boot camp at Hancock County in South Georgia. I mean, how much more unmanageable can you be than that? So that was pretty clear to me. And I wasn't really sure about being sane. A power greater than myself restored my sanity. That didn't excite me. But then when I heard what the actual alcoholic definition of insanity is, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results this time, it was pretty clear to me that I've been doing that forever. I had just been doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results most of my life. And so that was pretty easy for me to swallow. When I started to take a look at step three, I had a guy here that had been sponsoring me named Gene that goes to the Thursday night men's group, and I had been asking him how you did that step three. vehicles. I always, when they sent me over, I went to turnaround a couple times too, but they always sent me over here for turnaround, you know, to go to the 545. So I, when I came in, I saw this guy, Gene. I thought, oh, thank God, somebody I know. And I asked him to be my sponsor. And so right away, I thought, well, hell, I need to work steps, you know. And so I thought, well, you know, I'm power sober alcohol, a lot of time manager, when you might see that, you know. And I said, now I don't know about this being insane and having some higher power restore my sanity, but I guess I'm still up. That doesn't happen, so that step's done. And then I'd look at step three and I'd say, well, how do you turn your will and your life over to care of God as you understand it? Well, that one kind of ran me off the stump. I wasn't real sure about that. So as time went by and I drank more, I began to realize, and then when I started actually thinking about, I mean, I had asked God to remove the obsession. So what I did was I started, I looked at the step, and it says, made a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand God. So it just says make a decision. And what are we turning over? We're turning over our will, and our will is what we think, and our life is what we do. So, and all I had to do is make a decision. So I had to make a decision to turn my will, or I had to make a decision to turn my thinking and my life, which is what I do, over to the care of God. Now, how would somebody like me do something like that? Well, I couldn't see any way to do it, but if you look at the rest of the steps, in step five, we sit with our sponsor and we identify our character defects. We find out which ones we missed when we wrote down our step four. And then we ask God to remove that, six and seven. And then it says in step 10, if we actually are looking for some way to have God guide and direct our thoughts, then we are actually asking God to control what we do, which is our, you know, which our life is, or let's say our will is, what we think is our will and what we do is our life. And so if we're asking God to be in control of all that, all we're having to do in step three is make that decision to do that. And that was simple enough for me. That simplified the step where I could do it. And anybody that was sitting where I was sitting, who had known what I had done, who couldn't quit drinking like I couldn't quit, that's kind of where I was in life, would be crazy to say no to that. I mean, it just seemed like a very practical thing. It seemed to me like a big problem that I couldn't handle that had become very simple. For me, I could just simply make a decision to turn my will and my life over to care of God. So, especially when I found out all I had to do was work the rest, what that meant was work the rest of the steps. So that, I had a little bit of a tough time with step four because I had people who loved me that, and when we got this resentment list, it didn't seem right for me to put down my parents and my grandparents, and I couldn't think of but one person I'd known, and I was 37 years old. I couldn't think of but one person in my life I didn't have a resentment on, and so it was a long list. You know, I hated everybody, but you know, I wasn't prejudiced. I hated everybody evenly. That used to be my joke, you know. And so what I found out when I started looking at the fourth step was that you know, nobody really cared what I had done or what anybody else had done in my life. Nobody really cared. And but what the importance of doing the fourth step was, and the fifth step was, to identify what the character defects were that made me so mad at everybody and made me so afraid of everybody and made me so feel so guilty for the stuff I'd done, because without knowing what those things were, then I wasn't going to have anything. I wasn't going to be armed with anything to ask God to remove in six and seven, which is going to make working on these steps useless. So, and that's what the program was all about. And I learned that right about then, and I learned that by talking to a lot of people in the program. You know, when you're washed up on the bank and your life is really in shambles, it's amazing how much more intense you become when it comes to listening. You know, I was there, and I had a long, ugly bottom, and I was convinced that I had a good, thorough bottom, and I was convinced that, you know, I needed to do what I was doing. What I had been doing wasn't going to work, had not been been working for a long time, and I wasn't gonna, wouldn't die, so I had to change something. And if I was going to change something, what I needed to do was ask God to remove those character defects. And without doing a four-step, and without sharing that four-step with somebody, and Harry heard mine then back in those days, and Harry sat there for I don't know how many days, 20 days probably, I don't know how many days it was, 2 hours each time, and we sat there, this was, had to be about, 10 years ago, I guess, or something, 9 years ago, but there was a lot of times that you came over on the way to Roberts and sat over there, and I called him one time, and I've been sober for a couple of years dry, and I was at Ultra Mills, and I had one of these buy here, pay here car lot trucks, and I was living in one of Harry's rental houses, duplexes, and you know, my clothes were clean, my house was clean, the truck was clean, all that, all my help was paid, and I was at Falls at Ultra Mills watching my crew working across the street, had two crews putting in two footings, and I was standing there crying, and I couldn't figure out what in the hell was wrong with me. And I called him up, and I told him, I said, you know, I can't figure it out. You know, it's a sunny day, and I got a date tonight, the truck's washed, clothes clean, all that. I'm sitting here crying. My emotions just, I don't know how to control them. And he said, well, good, you might be about ready to work the steps. I'll be over at your house on Sunday morning, and I'll bring donuts, and you fix the coffee. And I thought, oh, shit, he don't even care. You know? So anyway, that was, and that was how I was introduced to the rest of it. So, and that was how I found out all about my character defects, and I learned how God will remove them when asked. The only thing is that we have to ask, and I have not been good at, I'm not good at asking anybody or anything for anything. I'm not asking good at asking anybody for anything. I'm very independent. I can do this by myself. I have a granddaughter that married last every time. I do this myself. She holds her finger like this when she's pointing at you. I do this myself. And just, you know, spit in the image of a grandfather. It's just, you know, just, yeah, you can do it yourself. You know, we got a chair for you, honey. That's what I'm thinking. And she, you know, you just don't know what you look like when you, what I look like to my parents and my grandparents. And, go ahead and do all that, and I did 6 or 7, and I did the best job I could do. I was ready to, I was tired of carrying on all that poison. I was just eating up with it, and I did my 8-step, and I was ready to make amends to people way early. I was much more ready to make amends to people before I ever did my first step than I was when I actually got to 8. And I wrote out my 8-step, and we organized and so forth, and I did, and then my financial restitution list was horrible. I can't imagine why somebody didn't shoot me. When I wrote down, when I discovered how much money I owed all these different people through the years, and I had no idea when I started all this I was going to have to give it to all of them. But, well, I did, and I had a lot of people I paid back that I wasn't supposed to pay back. That I had a bankruptcy in 1985. I bought a 1985 Silverado truck over at Polk Chevrolet, and the day I bought it, I was married then to Mary Number One, and we lived over there in Stone Mountain, right down the street from Tom's Barbershop, and I bought that 85 Silverado truck I had. It was a nice one, a Polk Chevrolet, and so I had a big garden. It's about 3/4-acre garden out in my backyard, and I was out there and drinking wild turkey and working in my garden, and so my friend Johnny Henderson down in Conyers called, and his wife was talking to my wife on the phone, and so he heard that I got a new truck, and before you know it, he was on the phone. I was talking to him. I said, yeah, I'll be down there in a little while. I was going to take for a ride in it. And he lived down on McDaniels Bridge Road in Conyers, and I lived in Stone Mountain. I'd probably had half a gallon of wild turkey. So before you know it, this little pickup truck I had was about maybe a 78 or 79 model. It had a rack on it, and it was a long bed, and had all kinds of stuff in the back of it. It was one of those trucks where you go around the corner about 5 minutes later, the back end comes around behind you, you know, you go about 50 miles an hour, and all of a sudden I got this brand new truck just, you know, squeal the tires. I didn't know pickups even did that. And, you know, it was two-tone red and silver, had this nice blue interior. It was really a nice one. And I couldn't wait for somewhere to go, and I was about half drunk. And by the way, I've been told the only alcoholics use that. You know, either you're drunk or you're not. The only alcoholics I was about half drunk. But anyway, so I took off, went down there, kind of picked him up, and went down the road, and I made it about maybe two or three blocks from his house and rolled it about seven or eight times. Anyway, that was one of the things that when I took that truck back, I'd had it about 3 or 4 hours, and they took me to this little jail down there and had my truck at Grady Young's or some little dump yard. The next morning they came and got me out of jail and went over and got my truck on a record, pulled it into Pope Chevrolet, and I looked like hell rolling over, you know. And I've been in jail all night long, had drank all this wild turkey, and my head was just pounding. And I pulled in and I said, they said, "How you doing, Mr. Scott?" I said, "Fine, I like another one of those." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "That truck out there on the back of that wrecker." And the guy said, "Oh, shit." And I said, "What's wrong?" He said, the salesman said, "I forgot to punch that back in as being sold." He said, "You wrecked that truck and you're driving it on a whatever they do, they punch you in the computer as test driving it, and then when you sell it, they're supposed to punch something else," and he forgot. And so I'd gone out and wrecked the truck, totaled it drunk, got a DUI, and so anyway, they fired him, sent him out the back door, Dick Pope comes walking out, and he said, "You're a contractor, you'll understand this, and, you know, this United States of America and all this." I stood over there with them, hangover, just listening. And I let him go for about 2 or 3 minutes, and I reached over, just grabbed his tie and snatched him over like that, and when I did, some great big old guy grabbed me from behind, and then peace plan or whatever, where you can't go on the property. So then I was unable to go down there to check on my truck, and it took me a month, and I had to hire a lawyer and pay $1,000 and get to make GMAC honor this thing. I got me another truck finally. It wasn't red and silver, it was just red. They didn't have one. But anyway, that was, I wound up, that's the first brand new truck I ever bought, and I learned a valuable lesson. That is, you ought to have some money saved up when you start a new business before you go out buying new trucks. Well, I bought this new truck and it rained for 3 months straight. At the end of that 3 months, I filed bankruptcy. Chapter 7. I didn't know that when I filed that Chapter 7 bankruptcy, I thought I was through with all those folks. They said, "Now, if you file," I went to see Paul, so I was sitting there watching the ball game. I saw Paul C. Parker on TV, that old bald headed guy, and loan consolidation, bill consolidation, or some stuff. So I said, "Yeah, I said, I need to go do the old Paul." So I went to see Paul Parker the next day, and I walked in. He said, "I need to make a list of all these people," and he said, "You need to file Chapter 7. Because if you file Chapter 11, you got to pay them all back anyway. And if you file Chapter 7, then you're through with all of them." And I said, "Well, I don't think I want to file Chapter 7. I said, "A lot of those Williams brothers and Garner Bill and Supply and all them." And I said, I hate to screw all those people out of their money. And he looked over his desk and pulled his glass and he said, "Son, I did a little screwing yesterday afternoon. It wasn't nothing like what you're talking about doing." And I thought, damn, he's the right guy for me, you know. So I filed Chapter 7. And so I didn't know that years later when I did my fifth step with Harry, I was going to have to go back and pay all these clowns that I didn't have to pay because I went to court. And I wound up having to pay a good many of those folks. Tucker was one. What's that villain's pop place? Not using me more over Tucker. They don't have to Tucker. Anyway, who is it? Cofer Brothers. Yeah, Cofer. Gene Cofer. I wound up having to pay all these clowns back anyway because the court said I didn't. I'm not real sure. I still understand that, but I had to go pay all these people back. And it took me a long long time. It took me till just before I met Mary before I finally had all this stuff paid back. So anyway, I finally did do all my 8th and 9th step restitutions and amends, and I've done the best job I could do to do a step 10 on a daily basis. I think I was doing 10 long before I've got step 10. On step 11, I've always been a real believer of meditation, prayer, and conscious contact with God. I think that clearly when we ask God to remove the obsession from us to drink, and we ask God to remove our character defects, and I can look back on things that I do occasionally and see where I am glad I didn't do something that I normally would have done. That's proof to me that God is at work in 6 and 7. There's actually been times in my life, a few of them, where I've been in a crowd of folks and they've been talking about something, and it was prime time for me to open my mouth and even my turn. And I might leave the room or keep my mouth shut, and later on, I'm thankful for that. And that's something that never used to happen to me. I was always, always sorry for something I said, or always sorry because I said too damn much or something. And that's God doing that, because that's not something that just happened to me. I guarantee you that. So I definitely believe that that having a conscious contact with God, working on a daily basis, and working with other alcoholics is paramount. I mean, it's, I don't know what I would have done here in the last couple of years. I had a decided to buy a road team motorcycle. I had a wreck on it. Somebody hit me and didn't stop. And then after the wreck was over, I was in a pretty bad state in the hospital, and they put me on this pain killer, and I got hooked on it. And after that, but I still worked the program. That's what's so damn funny about it. You know, I'm in AA, and I still stayed in my routine of meditation and prayer all the whole time, and I didn't drink. Now, you know, that's a miracle to me. Anyway, I don't know what I would have done all that time had it not been for my friends in the program and my sponsees. And I'm not sure how much they all understand that, and I'm definitely not sure that I understand it, but I know that it was quite an ordeal for me to overcome or to let go of, let's say, because it is a letting go process. It's not I'm going to take care of it type thing. So anyway, but I believe that if having sponsees and having sponsors and being active in the program is what keeps me alive, because it's impossible to talk to somebody all the time. If you talk to a sponsee and they want to know what to do, I'm not very good at telling anybody what to do. I'm pretty good at finding out what to do by looking in the big book and finding out what's suggested by the program. I mean, I'm not very good at coming up with stuff by myself. I usually come up with something that ain't too good. I believe that's the key, is having sponsorship, having people that love you, that you love. I never knew how to have a relationship before I got to AA. I never knew how. And it took me a long time. They say not to have a relationship for the first year after you get in the program. And I don't know who the hell made that rule. It should have been at least 5 in my case. But I wasn't sure as I wasn't ready in a year. I didn't know which was my elbow and which was a kneecap in a year. But anyway, it's been a good ride. I do know that working with others has been the key for me. And I think that's about all I got to say. I don't know. I probably left some stuff out. I probably left out everything I meant to say. But anyway, thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, David. That was just great.